We refer to this book for this week more than once, and we thought that we were out of all of them, but we do have one more book. Okay, if there's one sister, if she shows up, she gets the first dibs. If not, you can have the second dibs, okay? And you can have third dibs, but there won't be third dibs. I'm sorry. But Duane knows where to get these, so if you connect with him. And what this book is, I certainly don't know all the theologians in Andrew University, but the conservative Adventists that I interact with that have a little bit of understanding about the theologians at Andrew University, they say this is the one there that is the most faithful to conservative historic Adventism. And this book, as we've said once before, I don't believe that the book that he wrote here, it's called The Foundations of the Seventh-day Adventist Message and Mission. His name is P. Gerard Damsteed. I don't believe that he understands the significance that the Millerite time period is going to be repeated at the end of the world, but in terms of putting the history down of the Millerite time period, this is a classic. And once you begin studying the Millerite time period and you go to this book, there's things that just, you know, jump out at you. And one of the things that I want to read you here at the outset to try to tie into what we're going to share tonight, he's speaking about William Miller and how William Miller approached prophecy. And he describes the different approaches to prophecy that men were using back at that time. And he's showing why William Miller was different and people that were studying similarly to William Miller. And on page 22, on the top of the page, cutting into the paragraph, it says, in William Miller's analysis of the persecuting powers of God's people throughout the ages, and here's the part that I would like you to hear, and I don't think that this registers much with Adventists any longer, but what I'm hoping that you can see from this is this brother who, to me, is the finest historian on this history that I've ever read. I haven't read them all, but I mean, he's excellent. And this book is what they use for the course that he teaches to the pastors that come through his class. The classes that he is teaching is on Millerite history, and this is the textbook. So there's other people that understand that he's an authority on this. And he says this, in Miller's analysis, of the persecuting powers of God's people throughout the ages, he developed the concept of two abominations, defined as paganism, the first abomination, symbolizing the persecuting force outside the church, and the papacy, the second abomination, representing the persecuting power within the church. It was the motif of the two abominations that characterized most of his following prophetic interpretations. I'm on page 22. And what he's saying is the foundation to William Miller's logic of Bible prophecy is based upon identifying two desolating powers. And so what that means, among other things, is when we talk about the foundations of Adventism that were established by the pioneers, without a doubt, one of the foundational understandings of Adventism is that the book of Daniel is talking about two desolating powers. And it goes on to say, you know, that Miller's identifying the daily in the book of Daniel as paganism, the paganism desolating power. The second desolating power is the papacy, the papal desolating power. So when we get down here at the end of the world, and we find that we no longer teach the same thing about the daily as William Miller did, then I would suggest to you that those of us that are teaching something different don't know that we're attacking the foundation of Adventism. That's a foundational understanding of Adventism. And it is from the book of Daniel. You don't need the historians to tell you so. The book of Daniel is broken down that way. But this is the foundational perspective, the Bible prophecy of William Miller, is that there's two desolating powers that the book of Daniel is identifying. And when you look closely, you can break them out in several different places in the book of Daniel. You can identify these two powers. Daniel 9:26, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Daniel 2, two legs of iron, pagan Rome, papal Rome. Daniel 7, the fourth kingdom is diverse from the other kingdoms, and then there's going to be a little horn that comes up that is diverse from the first king. This fourth kingdom of Rome, pagan Rome, is called diverse. Papal Rome is called diverse. In Daniel 7, both phases of Rome are categorized under the diverse kingdom. In Daniel 8, verse 9, you have the little horn, and Miller and the pioneers identify the little horn as pagan Rome and papal Rome. And the story of the little horn goes from verse 9 through 12, and it's identifying both paganism and papalism. Daniel 11, both phases of the desolating power come under the category of the king of the north. Then you have the daily and the abomination of desolation in Daniel 11:31. You have the daily and the abomination of desolation in Daniel 12:11. You have the daily and the transgression of desolation in Daniel 8:13. Throughout the book of Daniel, two desolating powers are identified. So, if you've got that, if you follow me, what I really want you to follow is that when you identify the daily and the abomination of desolation as two desolating powers, you're in agreement with William Miller, and you're in agreement with William Miller's foundational understanding of Bible prophecy. Therefore, to have a different understanding of that at the end of the world means that you no longer are on the foundation. That's the logic I'm suggesting to you here. And in the first presentation that we did here on Sabbath, which was a long time ago now, and I don't have the notes as you do, but in your first presentation, there's a quote from Selected Messages, Book 3, I believe, Book 2 possibly, where Sister White is commenting on the ancient prophets, and she says, each of the ancient prophets spoke more for our day than the days in which they lived, so that their prophesying is in force for us, for those of us that live at the end of the world. And then she quotes 1 Corinthians 10:11. Now all these things happen as an example. The point is one of the principles that we identified at the very beginning is that each of the ancient prophets are speaking about the end of the world. So if you go to Isaiah, and it's in Isaiah 29, in verse 1 of Isaiah 29, and what I'm suggesting is let's look at Isaiah 29 in terms of that Isaiah is describing the end of the world. And he says, woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. And any Bible commentator, if you read on this verse, Ariel is another word for Jerusalem. It's like you call Los Angeles L.A. Ariel is another word for Jerusalem. And you can see it right in the verse. The city where David dwelt. Add year to year, let them kill sacrifices. So this passage is going to be talking about Jerusalem at the end of the world. In Testimonies Volume 5, Sister White's clear that Jerusalem at the end of the world is where? It's the Seventh-day Adventist church. Not just the church. He says the Seventh-day Adventist church. So this is a prophecy about the Seventh-day Adventist church at the end of the world. And this is simple prophecy here that we're going to go through. And we're not going to go through it in detail, but this is simple, I think. Look at let's start in verse 9. Stay yourselves and wonder, cry ye out, speaking of Jerusalem, and cry. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. He's talking about, I'm in 9 and 10 of Isaiah 29. He's talking about the Seventh-day Adventist church at the end of the world, and he's saying that we're drunken and that our eyes are closed. We can't see. And then it says in verse 11, and the vision of all is become to you as the words of a book that is sealed. Now, brothers and sisters, what book is sealed? The book of Daniel. At the end of the world, it's saying here that the book of Daniel is not going to be understood by Seventh-day Adventists. the people that are living in Ariel, the city where David dwelt. It says, and the vision is become unto you as the word of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I cannot, for it's sealed. So there's a group of people in the Seventh-day Adventist Church at the end of the world that Isaiah categorizes as the learned. You tell me who the learned are in the Adventist Church. The leaders, the teachers, the pastors, the theologians. And they're given the book of Daniel at the end of the world, and they say, we can't read it because it's sealed. But notice the next verse. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned. Who's that? That's everybody else. You know, Isaiah divides the Seventh-day Adventist Church up into two groups, the learned and the unlearned. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I am not learned. The learned in Adventism, they don't understand the book of Daniel because it's sealed. And the unlearned in Adventism, they don't understand the book of Daniel because they'll only understand it if someone that is learned teaches it to them. There's two arguments that bring about the same effect. The book of Daniel sealed up at the end of the world to Seventh-day Adventists. So, let's read down because it's going to talk about this condition, but then it's going to tell something very important. Verse 13, wherefore the Lord saith, forasmuch as this people, forasmuch as the Seventh-day Adventist people at the end of the world draw near me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark, and they say, who seeth us, and who knoweth us? But notice the next statement. Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as potter's clay. There's something that gets turned upside down in Adventism that shuts the door on our ability to understand the book of Daniel. This passage is about the book of Daniel being sealed up. It's about the book of Daniel being sealed up. And there's something that gets turned upside down that prevents us from understanding the book of Daniel. And brothers and sisters, let's just keep it real simple. The pioneers understood the daily in the book of Daniel to be a satanic power, paganism. Today in Adventism, we teach that the daily is Christ's work in the sanctuary, a godly power. It's totally opposite. It's been turned upside down. To not have the correct understanding of the daily in the book of Daniel is to destroy the foundational understanding of William Miller. William Miller's foundational understanding on how to relate to Bible prophecy is that it was identifying two desolating powers, paganism and papalism. And here at the end of the world, we've taken the part that's representing paganism and we've made it a godly power and we've eliminated our ability to understand the book of Daniel. Now, I've commented on this passage in Isaiah before to people that aren't as friendly to what we're saying. You know, people that are, say, responding written to people that are saying what we're teaching is erroneous, leaders of the Adventist Church. And it's nice to know when you do that, that Sister White applies this passage to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, not just me. So she quotes from here and says, of these words will be literally fulfilled. That's her words. So, you know, you're safe to apply this to Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm not just being mean-spirited. And I'm not trying to point out any bad guys in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm trying to emphasize the importance of maintaining the foundational understanding that the Millerites established, and the daily is foundational to them. That's in a quote by Sister White, which I don't have in front of me. I'm not taking the time to go really into depth to this, but I have the quote. I have the quote in these notes. I can get to you in the break if you really need to see that. Let me show you one more thing along this line before we take up our main study of tonight. There's a brother here. There's a brother here that every time that I come to California, he's usually in attendance. And he, from what I understand, he and I are pretty much like-minded. But there's one point of understanding that he and I are just a little bit off on, and it's nothing that I'm too afraid of. I hope he's not too afraid of it. And it's this. I believe that the first, second, and third angel's message came into history in the Millerite time period, and that we're waiting for the fourth angel's message, and that this 3-1 combination of this history and then later on the fourth angel's message, it's illustrated all over the place in sacred history, a lot of different places. And I believe that when you look closely at the characteristics of this third message, that it lines up with the Sunday law at the end of the world, for one thing, but that what is being taught, among other things, is that there is a separation that takes place right at the number 3 message, whereas the friend of mine who's here in the audience tonight and didn't know I was going to say anything about this, and I'm not trying to point out any misunderstanding with him, I'm trying to make a point. He believes the separation comes, you know, shortly before, somewhere in here. But I believe that prophecy is very specific about it taking place right here at the third test. Okay, and you can show that the fourth angel's message also includes a third test at the end of the world. The third test in the Millerite time period is where the door closed. At the end of the world, the door closes at the Sunday law. So what I'm saying is, when you take these different histories together, you see a separation at the third test. If you take this pattern back to the days of Noah, not Noah, well, even at Noah, but I meant to say Moses, at the Passover test, this is when the Israelites were allowed to leave Egypt. That's where the separation came, is at Passover. So the third decree, coming out of Babylon, this is where the final people came out of Babylon, at the third decree. There's a separation at this point over and over again emphasized. When you look at this separation, another thing that you find in connection with this separation, and it's particularly significant in the days of Christ, Sister White says that at the cross, which is the third test, that the Jews were left in perfect darkness. That's her words, early writing, page 259. Perfect darkness. And what does she say about the foolish virgins in the Millerite time period at the third test when the door was closed? That they continued to send their prayers into the holy place, and who was answering their prayers? Satan. There's a separation here, but not only is the separation there, it's specifically identified in Bible prophecy that those that are the foolish virgins at that separation point, that's when they come fully under the control of Satan. I mean, and there's a quote where Sister White says Seventh-day Adventists are the first to come fully under the control of Satan. And that's what she says. And that's because they're the first to be judged at the Sunday law time period, and those Seventh-day Adventists that haven't prepared their character for the seal of God receive the mark of the beast, and at that point in time, they fully, completely, forever separated from the influence of the Holy Spirit, and therefore they're under the influence of Satan, and they're simply paralleling the foolish virgins of the Millerite time period, or the Jews who put Christ on the cross. This is a history that's very specifically nailed down. And now here's my point. At the Sunday law, there's also a very important separation identified in scriptures where those of us that haven't prepared our character for the seal of God are going to come fully under the influence of Satan. And you're all familiar with it. You're all familiar with this passage. But you may not have applied it or thought about it in terms of the Sunday law. But this is when this prophecy is fulfilled. If you turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Verse 11. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11 says, "And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." This is the delusion. And if you run these quotes into Ellen White CD-ROM, the whole world's going to come under strong delusion as probation's closing. The whole world is going to be divided into two groups, the saved and the lost are going to receive strong delusion. But if you run these verses in Ellen White CD-ROM, you'll see that her primary application to the fulfillment of these verses is Seventh-day Adventists. There's a truth that Seventh-day Adventists reject that brings about this strong delusion. That's why we're told that Sister White says, by an increase of knowledge, God's people will be prepared to stand in the latter days. And Hosea 4:6 says, my people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. There's a truth that confronts God's people at the end of the world that if we don't receive it, this is what is responsible for putting us in the place where we receive the mark of the beast and receive this strong delusion, come fully under the control of Satan. You follow my logic? Because there's more to be said about this. Notice this. Go back a few verses. Let's start at verse 3. Now, brothers and sisters, how many have read where Sister White endorsed the style of study that William Miller used? You know, she comments on William Miller's type of biblical study and says, this is the way to study the Bible. She doesn't say it in those words, but she endorses William Miller's style of Bible study. We're all familiar with that, right? But she does. You know, we haven't got time to show it to you, but she does. She very specifically talks about how he studied the Bible and endorses that type of Bible study. And the way that William Miller studied the Bible and the way that she confirms is that he used a Bible and what other book? There's only one. A concordance. So, Cruden's. Yeah, it's in the Great Controversy when she's commenting on this. So, when he came across the word in the Bible that he didn't understand, then he would take his concordance and he'd look where, or word or phrase, he'd look wherever that word or phrase was found in the Bible and he'd read every place until he came to understand what the Bible defined that word or phrase was. That's his style of Bible study. And when he came to the daily, remember, William Miller is the man in Christian history, the first man to identify the daily in the book of Daniel as paganism. Before William Miller, the Christian churches said it was Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary. Now, then, the World Adventists teach the same thing. They don't realize that they've accepted the fallen Protestant position, but that's another story. William Miller discovered the daily, and when he describes how he found it, he was doing the regular thing that he always did. He says, in the book of Daniel, when you see the daily identified in chapter 8, chapter 11, and chapter 12, and he quotes all of those passages from 8, 11, and 12 when he's telling this story. He says, when you see the daily, you always see the words take away in connection with it. The daily's taken away, the daily taken away. So he's using his concordance looking for something that's taken away to give him an idea of what the daily could be because he didn't understand what it was. And he made a very important comment in that same passage. He says, I realized that the word daily is only found in the book of Daniel. And it is. You can find continual throughout the Bible, but it's only used as a noun in the book of Daniel. It's totally different than the other places in the Bible. And William Miller states that. He understood it. It's the only place it's found in the book of Daniel. And he begins looking for what is it that's taken away. So he comes to 2 Thessalonians verse 3. And it says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. And who's this speaking about? The papacy. The papacy is the man of sin, right? Verse 4. Who opposeth and exalted himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he is God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things. Well, what does Paul mean by that? What Paul means by that is that he had previously been in Thessalonica, and he had taught this truth to the Thessalonians that he's going to teach them here in this passage. But this truth was of such a radical and volatile nature that Paul didn't want to write it in a letter. He didn't want to be specific, because if the pagan Roman authorities would find this letter, whoever had a letter specifically identifying what he was going to say, they'd probably be put to death. And so would the whole church if they found it in the church. So what Paul says here in verse 5 is, remember, I already gave you this sermon. So I'm going to kind of cloak what I'm going to say and remind you of what I said in that sermon. I cannot afford to be specific about this because it might get me in trouble and it might get you in trouble. He's talking about the papacy in verses 3 and 4, the man of sin that's destined to arise in history. And he says, remember, I told you this already. And then in verse 6, he begins talking in kind of a hidden, with some hidden words. He says, and now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. Who might be revealed in his time? The papacy. He's talking about the papacy. But he's saying there he is withholding. There's something holding the papacy back. And then he continues about the papacy, verse 7. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth, and this word letteth, in my margin, it says hindereth. But the Greek, probably the best expression of this word letteth, is restraineth. He who now restraineth. There is a power that Paul is talking about that he doesn't want to name specifically, that is restraining the papacy from taking control of the world. It says, for the mystery of iniquity doth already work. The papacy is already working. Only he who is now restraining the papacy will continue to restrain until he be taken out of the way. And when William Miller writes that phrase, he says something like this, oh, glorious be this thought, this is the daily. It's saying the power that's restraining the papacy from taking control of the world is the daily. And this verse is saying it will continue to restrain the papacy until it's taken out of the way. And what was the power that was restraining the papacy? Pagan Rome. Yeah, it's in his and it's also in a very important Review and Herald article from 1858, where Uriah Smith and James White and maybe some other editors went through and gave the understanding of the daily, and they quote from several different pioneers, and they quote from Miller in that. And I'm sure it's in this book. I don't remember reading it, but I can't imagine him.
I think it's in there,
Bob. You know, it may not be in there, but it's easy access. And this is when he realized that this restraining power, the power that was restraining the papacy, that Paul is saying it will continue to restrain until it's taken out of the way. Then he found the daily that would be taken away in the book of Daniel. And this is the passage that William Miller uses to make his case that the daily is paganism in general and pagan Rome specifically. But let's read on. And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned, who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. How many are familiar with that quote, that passage there? We've all heard about the people that don't have a love of the truth, and they're going to receive strong delusion. We've read that hundreds of times, right? We've heard it preached about. But has anyone ever asked you, what's Paul talking about here? What is the love of the truth that Seventh-day Adventists at the end of the world are not going to possess? What truth is being talked about here? Is it the health message? Is it country living? Is it the Sabbath? Is it the state of the dead? It's the daily. It's the relationship of pagan Rome and papal Rome. That's what Paul's talking about here. That's what he's talking about. And that's when Isaiah 29 says the book of Daniel is sealed up to Adventists at the end because they've turned something upside down. And what we've turned upside down, brothers and sisters, is the understanding of the daily. Pioneers taught it was a satanic power. And here at the end of the world, we're teaching it's a godly power. And it eliminates, and some of you came in late, which is fine, but I want to read this for you and just to cement it in our head one more time. This is the college course book in Adventism for teaching the Millerite history. And when this theologian that wrote this book is summarizing the basic foundation of William Miller's reasoning on Bible prophecy, this is what he says. In his analysis, Miller's, of the persecuting powers of God's people through the ages, he developed the concept of two abominations. Defined as paganism, the first abomination, symbolizing the persecuting force outside the church, and the papacy, the second abomination, representing the persecution power within the church. It was the motif of the two abominations that characterized most of his following prophetic interpretations. the foundational understanding of William Miller when he approached Bible prophecy is that it's identifying two desolating powers, paganism and papalism, the daily and the abomination of desolation. That's page 22 in this book. So, here we are at the end of the world. Any, you know, if you tell someone that believes the daily is Christ's sanctuary ministry, they're probably, if they're not going to accept this understanding, they're going to say, well, you know, is that really a foundation of Adventism? Because what I'm saying is this is the foundation of Miller's thinking, and certainly Miller has to be one of the people that put the foundations together, all right? What was the original name for the Seventh-day Adventists? Millerites, okay? So there's a logic there that's pretty much irrefutable, but let's remind ourselves. Most of us are familiar with 1888, a little bit about 1888. And there's a passage that you may remember reading, and it has nothing to do with the daily, but it has an important aspect on it. And I did not bring this quote out, so I hope most of you are familiar with this. There was an argument going on in that time period, and one of the basic argument was that Jones and Wagner were attacking the foundations. Okay? And do you remember what Sister White said about that? She says that those people that are saying that, they no longer know what the foundations are. You know, she says that. And then she describes what the foundations were. After that, she says, these are the foundations I can think of no more that would be called the foundations. There's a common spirit of prophecy quote that people use in that regard. And all I want to suggest to you is that by 1888, inspiration says God's people were already forgetting what the foundations were. That's over 100 years ago. So there's no reason to think that we've become any more familiar with the foundations when Revelation 10:4 says the history where the foundations were established would be sealed up until the end of the world. I mean, this is where we're at. So I'm not going to go back up into the 2520, but I'm going to remind you of something from the last couple nights. When Hiram Edson understands the 2520 is beginning in 723 BC and ending in 1798, he discovers a time prophecy that is 1,260 years of paganism trampling down God's people, followed by 1,260 years of papalism trampling down God's people. And this is one of the strongest arguments in support of William Miller's logic you'll ever find. And William Miller probably never even heard about it. You know, Edson did. Edson talks about it. But, I mean, Miller was still alive probably by then, but I'm sure he wasn't following what was going on in Adventism. So, with that being said, I wanted to touch. We're closing up on the 1843 chart here this evening. And my wife said last night or the night before, you know, you need to touch on Isaiah 29. She likes that presentation as much as any other. There's something that's clear. Isaiah says something gets turned upside down that prevents God's people from understanding Daniel. And it's clear, it's the daily. That's what's been turned upside down prophetically. That removes our ability to understand prophecy here at the end of the world. If you turn to Daniel 11, verse 14, we'll start going a different direction now. Daniel 11, verse 14 says, "And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall." The Protestant understanding in the time period of William Miller of who the robbers of thy people are in verse 14 is that this is the last of the Syrian kings. This is the final remnants of the kings of Greece. William Miller opposed that position. You know, there's just not that many things that William Miller put in the record. He didn't address, you know, every book in the Bible. He only addressed certain topics, at least that we have a record of. And this is one of them. He wrote about his argument on this subject. He says, "The Protestants are wrong. The robbers of thy people is a new power introduced into verse 14. And it's the power in the book of Daniel that exalts itself. And it's the power that establishes the vision, and it's the power that falls." And in the book of Daniel, the power that falls and exalts themselves is Rome, and that's what William Miller suggested, is that the robbers of thy people here is Rome. And here at the end of the world, we have reverted. Many of our modern theologians have reverted to say that the robbers of thy people are the last of these Syrian kings, but that's not Miller's position. And I suggest to you that it's still Rome. And why is that important? Because we have a vision at the end of the world. We have a message at the end of the world. William Miller had a vision. The Millerites had a vision. Their vision was Daniel 8:14, under 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. The first angel's message. Our vision at the end of the world is the third angel's message, a warning against receiving the mark of the beast. We have a vision at the end of the world, and our vision is the vision that all the Bible prophets were speaking about, because the Bible's prophets were speaking more about the end of the world than the days in which they lived in. When the Bible's talking about the vision at the end of the world, it's talking about our day and age more than any other passage. And in the end of the world, the prophetic key that establishes the vision is Rome. It's Rome. That's what verse 14 says. That's how the Millerites understood it. So, well, this is pagan Rome. This is pagan Rome. William Miller identified this as pagan Rome being introduced into this verse. But in terms of a prophetic symbol, it's okay to say Rome in general. For this, and you'll see why I suggest that in a moment. But you can put pagan Rome in specific for that verse. But in general, it is Rome, both pagan and papal, that establishes the vision. Now, in our first presentations, I don't know how many of you were here from Sabbath and Sunday meetings. I think we probably were done by Sunday on this theme, but we dwelt a great deal on the different places in inspiration where we're taught that the Millerite time period is repeated again at the end of the world to the very letter. That's one of the arguments that we're looking at this 1843 chart. We're saying this 1843 chart had a present truth fulfillment in the Millerite time period, and that here at the end of the world, it once again is having a present truth fulfillment in a different way. You know, they were using it to take the message of the world. We're using it to identify what the foundations are so we can make sure that the prophecies we're understanding are built upon the foundations. But in that time period, there is something that, and this book brings it out well, but you don't need this book to understand it. I've been suggesting this long before I knew this book existed. But this book brings it out well. One of the things that happened in the Millerite time period is that the Lord used William Miller to establish certain rules of prophetic interpretation. And they're in the back of this book. There are other places, too. You can get William Miller's Rules of Prophetic Interpretation. But the one that we're all familiar with is the year-day principle of Bible prophecy. And where's the first place you can demonstrate the year-day principle of Bible prophecy? In the Bible. Where's the first place you can show it to someone? Numbers. And who wrote Numbers? Moses. So the year-day Bible principle of Bible prophecy has been in the Bible since Moses. It's been in there, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But it wasn't until the time period of William Miller that the year-day principle of Bible prophecy changed from truth to present truth. William Miller's rules of Bible prophecy were rules that he gathered together that were present truth in the sense that they were the prophetic rules that needed to be understood and used to establish the message for that time period. That's just the way it was. And so when you go into this history book, which tells you the history before 1844 and the history up to 1873, after 1844. After 1844, William Miller began going astray, correct? We all understand that. He didn't accept the Sabbath, and then he didn't accept the midnight cry, and he just went astray. As he was going astray, and those people that remained on the narrow path, Ellen White and the other pioneers that stuck with the truth, as they started defending why they disagreed with William Miller on his understandings after 1844, what rules do you suppose they used to show that William Miller was getting off track? William Miller's rules. Brothers and sisters, the pioneers, it wasn't just William Miller that was using those rules. William Miller is the man that the Lord used to put those together. But the pioneers, the Millerites, they were all familiar with those rules, and that's what they were using. Even after William Miller left the movement, they still continued to use those rules. They were the standard for establishing the present truth message during that time period. Therefore, I suggest that when you get to the end of the world, there will be rules of Bible prophecy that have been in the Bible for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they've always been true, but at this point in history, they become present truth because they're the rules that you need to identify and acknowledge in order to bring the final warning message into clarity. And one of those rules, I believe, has to do with Rome. And you find, we're going to keep this simple, and in the notes that you have, I should probably see where they are in this. Let me just see if I can get on the same story. On your last set of notes, is your last notes the three woes? I have different notes than you. Very last sermon. Before conclusions of questions. The three woes. Let's turn there. We can be on the same. 148 in yours. 170 in mine. 148. So let me tell you what I believe is one of the rules that is important at the end of the world to establish the vision at the end of the world, the vision being the prophetic message connected with the Sunday law. The first component of that rule is that it is Rome that establishes the vision. And when you approach Rome in Bible prophecy, you'll find that there are certain prophecies that have a direct connection with Rome that are repeated three times. Another biblical rule that you need to incorporate into this understanding is mentioned many times in the Bible, and it's upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. So when you find these prophecies connected to Rome that are repeated three times, the internal rule that is developed in these prophecies is that the first two times the prophecy is fulfilled identifies the characteristics that will exist the third time that they come to pass. Now, we've already looked at some here. This is easier than you think. We're not going down through that yet. I'm speaking now. I'll point you to the quotes when we get there. I'm just setting out the rule, basic overview, and then I'm going to start showing it to you if I can. And here's what it is. The first testimony, the first prophetic testimony combined with the second prophetic testimony will give you the characteristics of the third testimony. These threefold prophecies always have to do with Rome, and we call them a triple application of prophecy. This is just the formula. And I would suggest to you that one of the messages that we understand as Seventh-day Adventists that we've been raised up to proclaim is the fourth angel's message. And now in your notes, you have Revelation 18:2, the fourth angel's message. And it says, "And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird." I would submit to you that once you understand this triple application of prophecy, you'll realize that right there in that message is a representation of a triple application of prophecy. What do I mean by that? Our message is to identify Babylon at the end of the world. This is 11. And Belshazzar's Babylon fell, and I'm not too sure about Belshazzar, fell in chapter 5 of Daniel. When you take the prophetic characteristics of Nimrod's fall of Babylon, and you combine those characteristics with the prophetic characteristics of the fall of Babylon with Belshazzar, you will identify
the characteristics of modern Babylon's fall. It's a triple application of prophecy, but it is symbolized, represented, however you want to express it, in the very message that we all know that we're going to proclaim. Babylon is fallen, is fallen. This message here in Revelation 18:2 isn't so much, you know, that we go out to the world and say, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. What it's saying is the way that we're going to illustrate the fall of Babylon to the world is by going into these two histories of the fall of Babylon and using these two histories to identify how modern Babylon comes down. And brothers and sisters, if you look closely at the information that we have about Nimrod's collapse, including what Sister White says about it, and Belshazzar's collapse, you'll see that all the characteristics that we understand about the fall of modern Babylon are in these two histories. When you take these characteristics with this characteristics, you establish the characteristics of the third Babylon. We have already looked at a triple application of prophecy. Notice that on Babylon, it's dealing with Rome. Modern Babylon is modern Rome. It's one of the characteristics of the triple application of prophecy is it's connected to Rome, and Rome establishes the vision. One that we've already looked at, and in this book, he points out when the Adventists were, after 1844, when they were trying to figure out who they were and what they were after the disappointment, where they fit into sacred history, the first discovery they made in the scriptures to identify for them who they were was the story of Elijah. Foundational understanding after the disappointment is that Seventh-day Adventists come to understand themselves as the third Elijah, the first Elijah. In his story, you find some very important information about Rome, because he had to deal with Jezebel, who was married unlawfully to Ahab, and Jezebel was controlling the prophets of Baal. Jezebel, impure woman, impure church at the end of the world. Ahab, a king, a civil power at the end of the world. Prophets of Baal do the dance of deception. That's the first application of that history. The second application, Jesus said that John the Baptist was Elijah. And John the Baptist had to deal with Herodias, an impure woman who was married to a civil power unlawfully. It's his brother's wife. And Salome, her daughter, did the dance of deception. Two prophetic testimonies. The characteristics of these two testimonies will establish the final fulfillment of it. The final fulfillment of it. I'll put 144,000, but it's not simply the 144,000, is it? Because Elijah represents, when you combine them together, Elijah represents 144,000 and John the Baptist represents those that die in the faith of the third angel's message before the return of the Lord. Yeah, in the first time we went over this here, I said there's some people in Adventism that say that Sister White is the third Elijah, and I don't argue that. I understand that definitely. I teach that she is a type of an Elijah, but from a different approach. In this, there's parables, illustrations can have more than one meaning. But the primary meaning of this history of Elijah, it's more than anything else, it's telling us who the threefold enemy of God's people is at the end of the world. It's the beast, the Vatican, the United Nations, a world civil power, and the United States that does the dance of deception. The Protestantism is the daughters of the papacy, right? Right? Salome, the daughter of Herodias. The United Nations is the 10 kings in Revelation 17, brothers and sisters. 10 kings. Ahab was the king of what? The northern kingdom. How many tribes were there? 10. Civil power. At the end of the world, it's a one world. It's the whole world's going to be confronted with this. This civil power has to be a world civil power. This isn't the European common market. It's going to encompass the whole world. The unlawful marriage here, combination of church and state between the papacy and the United Nations. Why does that take place? In Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15, the United States goes out to the whole world and tells the world that they need to set up an image of the beast. And there's only one definition of the image of the beast in inspiration. It's the combination of church and state with the church in control of the situation. The reason the world is going to accept this one world government, the image of the beast in verses 14 and 15 of Revelation 13, is because the United States is going to deceive them into doing it. That's what Revelation 13 says. The United States does the dance of deception that's been prefigured by Salome and the prophets of Baal. In these stories, was Jezebel in the story? No, she was behind the scenes back in Samaria. Was Herodias in the story of John the Baptist losing his head? No, she's behind the scenes. Yes, they're in the story, but my point is that they're behind the scenes. Today, on planet Earth, the papacy is behind the scenes, and we're watching the actions of the United States, and in a secondary sense, we're watching the actions of the United Nations and one other player, which we're heading towards, Islam. But the Vatican is doing what? It's pulling the strings of the United States. It's pulling the strings of the United States. How do we know that? Because we know that Jezebel was controlling the prophets of Baal and that Herodias was controlling Salome. Do we not know that? So we know from Bible prophecy, whether we're understanding the communications that's going on between the Vatican and George Bush right now, whether we are aware of them, they're going on. They're pulling the strings. And there's a whole lot more. There's a whole lot more of important end-time understanding to develop from out of this triple application of prophecy. Elijah, 144,000 do not taste death. John the Baptist, the faithful that are martyrs in this time period. You bring these two testimonies together, the first two times gives you the characteristics of the third. Right? You with me on just the principle of a triple application of prophecy? Upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. We've mentioned the Babylon has fallen. Now we've shown you a second one. And this has to do with Rome, because it's giving us the threefold makeup of modern Rome: the beast, the dragon, the false prophet. And some of you may have never heard that the United Nations is the dragon power at the end of the world. And we have information. It's the most of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet. The dragon, being the United Nations, is the least understood in Adventism. But believe it or not, there is a mountain of prophetic evidence to demonstrate it. The number 10 is one of them. Ahab was the king of the 10 northern tribes. Daniel chapter 2, the 10 toes. That's the 10 kings of Revelation 17. And I know the pioneer understanding here on this. Sister White did not endorse it. She says the 10 toes takes place at the end of the world, and that the iron and clay represents the combination of church and state at the end of the world. In Psalm 83, you see a confederacy of 10 tribes. The purpose of the tribes is to attack God's people. You can count those tribes. It's the same confederacy as the 10 kings of Revelation 17. There's some of almost the identical phrases in Psalm 83 as is in Revelation 17. And in Ezekiel 37, you see a judgment brought against Egypt. And when the judgment's brought against Egypt, Egypt consists of not 11 cities and not 9 cities, but 10 cities. 10 is the number of the one world government, the civil power at the end. The Revelation 13:2, the dragon, pagan Rome, Revelation 13:2 says the dragon was going to give three things to the papacy: its power, its seat, and its great authority. Authority in Bible prophecy is civil authority. Civil authority. This is the civil power at the end of the world. And pagan Rome gave the civil authority to the papacy in the year 533. Pagan Rome gave its military power to the papacy from the years 496 with Clovis until 508 with King Arthur and beyond. They continue to give it, but that's how when the seven European kings came into church-state relationship. Pagan Rome gave its seat to the papacy in the year 330. So what I'm saying here is that even in Revelation 13:2, the reason that Revelation 13:2 tells us that pagan Rome, the dragon, gave its power, seat, and great authority to the papacy in Revelation 13:2, it wasn't just a mundane comment. It was telling us that at the end of the world, when the papacy is reestablished, once again there will be three things given to the papacy. Power, military power supplied by the United States. Civil authority supplied by the United Nations. And the papacy is once again going to be seated upon this threefold arrangement. And that's what Sister White says. Under one head, the papal power. These histories parallel this threefold division of Rome at the end of the world. And so, in any case, that's a triple application of prophecy, and you can build.
What was the 10 for under the UN there?
The 10 kings of Revelation 17. That's a triple application of prophecy. There was a brother here on Sabbath, I believe, but I don't remember now. I think it was Sabbath. And he asked about the abomination of desolation, and we went through that very quickly before we started a presentation. And the abomination of desolation is a triple application of prophecy. The abomination of desolation was fulfilled by pagan Rome in AD 70 time period. The abomination of desolation was fulfilled by the papacy during the Dark Ages. And the abomination of desolation gets fulfilled at the end of the world at the Sunday Law in the United States. If you want to understand the characteristics of the Sunday Law at the end of the United States in terms of the abomination of desolation, you take the characteristics of when it was fulfilled with pagan Rome. You combine it with the characteristics of the abomination of desolation being fulfilled with papal Rome, and you'll establish what Sister White says about the Sunday Law being a sign to flee the cities. It's already been established by the first two times the abomination of desolation was fulfilled. And that is a triple application of prophecy that has a connection to Rome. So we went over that. You have that in your notes. You'll see, for those of you that it may be new about the dragon power being the United Nations, one of the places that we sometimes miss that is because Sister White says the dragon represents spiritualism. And on the second page of your notes, you'll see a quote from Testimonies to Ministers that says, kings and rulers and governors, that's a plurality of political figures. Kings, rulers, and governors have placed... Now don't go back to page two of your notes. Go to the second page of the last sermon, which I don't know the page number of. I'm 149. You'll see under the subtitle Kings, Civil Authorities, Dragon, United Nations, the third comment there is from Testimonies to Ministers, page 38, and it says, kings and rulers and governors have placed upon themselves the brand of Antichrist and are represented as the dragon. The dragon, page 150, that's on page 150. Kings and rulers and governors have placed upon themselves the brand of Antichrist and are represented as the dragon. A plurality, a group of political figures, the United Nations. Look at Isaiah 8, verses 9 through 12. Take the verses from, if you want to write this down for your own study, write down Isaiah 8, verses 9 through 12. Where Isaiah is saying, say ye not a confederacy with those that say confederacy. And you punch those verses into the Ellen White CD-ROM. And she identifies an evil confederacy at the end of the world. And there's no doubt about it that Isaiah 8, 9 through 12 is talking about the United Nations. Because when Sister White's talking about the evil confederacy in Isaiah 8, 9 through 12, she says it's Freemasons, that's her words, the world bankers. Their religion is spiritualism. It's all the components that anyone that knows anything about the United Nations knows is the United Nations. The Bible is just real clear, if you look at it, the role of the United Nations. It's a one-world crisis at the end. It's not simply in Europe. It's not simply in the United States. It's a worldwide event. So, another triple application of prophecy, and you have it on your next page, which should be 151. Yes, is the three Romes. And you'll see an illustration of pagan Rome, papal Rome, pagan Rome, papal Rome. And this isn't all of them. Different characteristics of pagan Rome and papal Rome that are identical. They're identical to each other. And what they're doing is upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. If pagan Rome was a persecuting power, and it was, and papal Rome was a persecuting power, then we know that modern Rome will be a persecuting power. upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. In the prophetic story of the Romans in the Bible, and Rome establishes the vision, in the prophetic testimony of pagan Rome, when you take that and combine it with the prophetic testimony of papal Rome, you identify modern Rome at the end of the world. And you can look these over. Look at the one where it says on your notes, pagan Rome, time prophecy identifying how long it would rule the world supremely. How many are aware that there is a time prophecy identifying how long pagan Rome would rule the world supremely? Raise your hands high so I have a sense. Okay. Turn with me, if you would, to Daniel 11:24. Now remember, the easiest way to test what I'm saying here and have a certain amount of confidence in it, if this is an unfamiliar verse for you, is to go to the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith. And every Seventh-day Adventist is to own that book, because Sister White says we're to be giving it out to our neighbors. And if we're going to give it away to our neighbors, then we must possess it. And when Sister White comments on that book by Uriah Smith, she says it's God's helping hand. And there's some problems in that book. She doesn't say everything in it's perfect, but it is still, to this day, the very finest representation of the pioneer understanding of Daniel and Revelation that's ever been printed. So when she says it's God's helping hand, her statement still is true, you know, a hundred years later. And if you read that, or even if you read Haskell's book on Daniel, you'll find that the pioneer understanding of verse 24, they're just in agreement, and so is history. Verse 24 is speaking about pagan Rome. And when you get down to the last couple phrases of verse 24, it says, "And he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time." What's a time? It's a prophetic year. And how many days are in a prophetic year? 360. And this verse is identifying that pagan Rome would rule the world supremely for 360 years. Now, if you turn back to Daniel 8, verse 9, and this is in Uriah Smith's book. See, Seventh-day Adventists at the end of the world, we don't know this anymore. And it's right there in that book that's been sitting on our bookshelf. If you go back to Daniel 8, verse 9, it says, "And out of one of them came forth a little horn." This is pagan and papal Rome. The little horn is the subject of verses 9, 10, 11, and 12 here. But primarily in verse 9, it's talking about pagan Rome, and it says, "Out of one of them came forth a little horn, pagan Rome, which waxed exceedingly towards the south, towards the east, and towards the pleasant land." And the three countries that pagan Rome had to conquer were Israel, the pleasant land, Syria, the south, and Egypt, the south. Egypt, the south, Syria, the east. Okay? And the third of those conquests was perhaps the most famous naval battle in history. It was the Battle of Actium. And at that point, pagan Rome took control of the world, and that battle was fought in 31 BC. And pagan Rome, from that point on, was invincible for 360 years until the year 330, when Constantine moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. And pagan Rome still ruled the world, but then it started to fall apart. Pagan Rome ruled the world supremely for 360 years based upon a time prophecy. And so did the papacy. It ruled the world for 1260 years supremely based upon a time prophecy. Notice that both pagan Rome and papal Rome, before they would rule supremely, they had to overcome three geographical areas. Pagan Rome, it was Israel, Syria, Egypt. For papal Rome, it was the Goths is much simpler, and the Vandals. And what was the third that the papists was removed for the papacy? What was the third of these that was removed? The Goths. And when did the Goths flee the city of Rome?
March 26th, 538.
And then the papacy ruled supremely for 1260 years. Point is, Pagan Rome had to overcome three geographical obstacles, and then it ruled the world supremely. Papal Rome had to overcome three geographical areas, then it ruled the world supremely. This is one of the things these time prophecies teach us. It's emphasizing them ruling supremely. Pagan Rome continued to be the power in the world after 330. It just wasn't doing it supremely anymore. It had reached a time where the kingdom was divided and beginning to fall apart. So when modern Rome returns to power, based upon the testimony of two, you know that modern Rome's going to have to overcome how many geographical areas before it rules the world supremely? Three. So when you get to Daniel 11:40 and it says the king of the south, and verse 41 says the glorious land, and verse 42 and 43 say Egypt, what are, not who are, but what are the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt? They're geographical areas. Because that's the way it was with pagan Rome and papal Rome. They have to be geographical areas. The Soviet Union, 1989. The United States, in the very near future. And Egypt symbolizes the whole world, all the countries of the world. So, that's a triple application of prophecy. And when you look closely, see, you may not be aware of it. The foundational study that we present, brothers and sisters, is Daniel 11, 40-45. If I have the opportunity to share prophecy with someone in one evening, and I'm going to be with them in one evening in an airport or something, and I have to decide, what do I want to share for one evening with this soul before I leave? I'm not going to tell them about the 1843 chart. And I'm not going to tell them about the pioneer time period being repeated at the end of the world. I'm going to tell them about Daniel 11, 40-45. That is the foundational study that we do. And if you're not up to speed on that, you at least need to test it and see if what we're suggesting about it is valid, even though we haven't dealt with it here. And because it is valid, because it is the message, there is a resistance to this message. And one of the primary arguments against what we present is that the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt are not three geographical areas. There's a teaching in Adventism that says, well, the king of the south may very well be the Soviet Union, a geographical area, but the glorious land is the Seventh-day Adventist church, a spiritual entity. And maybe Egypt is the world. There's not much said by those opponents about Egypt. But the point is this. Based upon the testimony of pagan Rome and papal Rome, Bible prophecy is clear that the modern Rome has to overcome three geographical areas. Not a geographical area and then a church. In fact, there's quotes where Sister White says something like this. She says, from the rise and fall of kingdoms as made plain in the books of Daniel and Revelation. She says kingdoms. She doesn't say churches. That's the focus of Daniel and Revelation, is political struggle. Political struggle. Anyway, when you use a triple application of prophecy and you come to pagan Rome and papal Rome, identify modern Rome, you are drawing one of the strongest arguments to defend the correct understanding of Daniel 11, 40-45, because if you're going to defend it, you're going to have to show who the glorious land is in verse 41. And I simply agree with Hiram Edson. It's the United States of America. So, with all that being said, there are other triple applications of prophecy, but we've mentioned four of them there. Babylon has fallen, Elijah, the three abominations of desolations, and pagan Rome and papal Rome. But now we want to go back to the 1843 chart. If you have not spent the time that's correct. Can you do... Well, I need to find it, so I want to say something first. I'm in notes from Blythe, but it's... I don't know if me looking for the quote that I'm looking for will do us any good, because then we're going to have to correlate it to that book, and it might take more time than it's worth. I'm looking for a quote that I know has to be... I found it here in mine. I can tell you what sermon it is in. It's in the sermon titled... The Seven Thunders Summary. Do you have the Seven Thunders Summary? Let me read this to you. This is some. Okay, it's about 10 pages. Let me. 22? You know, I'll find you the page with the quote that I want to read to you is on. Perhaps. I don't see it in these. These are okay, here you go. On page 20. Look on the bottom page 20. Very familiar quote.
What page in your book?
In my book it's 62. If you're not familiar, if you're not looking at prophecy where you're trying to understand the significance of the first angel's message of August 11th, 1840. Brothers and sisters, on August 11th, 1840, the Ottoman Empire collapsed. That was the fulfillment of a time prophecy found in Revelation 9, verse 15. The time prophecy was for 391 years and 15 days. That is when the mighty angel, who Sister White says is Christ, came down in Revelation 10. That is also the first angel's message. So this event has a connection with in more than one area of prophecy, and the areas that it connects with are of utmost importance for Seventh-day Adventists to understand. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire is where the Millerite message is empowered, the first angel's message of Revelation 14 arrives in history, the mighty angel of Revelation 10 comes down. It's just, there's an abundant amount of information to understand in connection with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. But if you're not looking at that closely, then you're not aware of how many arguments within Adventism there are that attack this truth, attacks it. And since I've been here, I was handed off a study that has taken place right in this congregation that attacks this. And the attack is, it's subtle. It doesn't openly attack Sister White, but it attacks Sister White. It attacks Sister White. So I want to read this to you from Great Controversy and show you, give you a little bit of insight on the attack so you could maybe get sense the significance of this passage more fully. The only reason that this passage has been under attack is because Satan knows that it is a key that we must understand correctly. There's not very few things in prophecy that if you go back through Adventist history that you're going to find controversies about. There are some. The Daily is one. The King of the North is one. This is one. There's arguments about whether we reapply the time prophecies of Daniel 12 at the end of the world. But in terms of Advent history, actual controversies, there isn't that many, but this is one of them. And so it says, in the year 1840, this is from the Great Controversy, in the year 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest. Brothers and sisters, just with that sentence, what does she say? She says there was a fulfillment of prophecy in 1840, right? Keep that in your mind. No matter whatever, we're not arguing about what prophecy it is or not. What I'm trying to make a point of now here is no matter what was fulfilled in 1840, Sister White says there was a prophecy fulfilled in 1840. Right? I'm not stretching that. Okay, and then she says, 2 years before, and that should be capitalized. I don't know why it isn't. Maybe it is in yours. 2 years before, Josiah Litch, one of the leading ministers preaching the Second Advent, published an exposition of Revelation 9 predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire on August 11, 1840, when the Ottoman power in Constantinople may be expected to be broken. And this, I believe, will be found to be the case. And in the next paragraph, she says, at the very time specified, Turkey, through her ambassadors, accepted the protection of the Allied powers of Europe and thus placed herself under the control of Christian nations. The event exactly fulfilled the predictions. You've had a study circulated in this congregation here in the recent past that taught that when Sister White says here, the event exactly fulfilled the prediction, that what was the event that she's speaking of is that Josiah Litch published his exposition of Revelation 9. And that the event that fulfilled the prediction was, the event she's discussing is the publication of Josiah Litch and not the prophecy of Revelation 9:15. That's the argument. And it's an argument that's used more than here. It's to my mind, it's a real just out and out blatant twisting of the scriptures. But if that were the case, if she's talking about the event here, when she says the event exactly fulfilled the prediction, if she's saying the event isn't the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, but that what she's saying is the event is what Josiah Litch did in 1840, then you have to, if you're going to take that position, you have to show me in the Bible where there's a prophecy that predicted that in 1840, Josiah Litch was going to present a false understanding of some prophecy that the Lord was going to use to empower the Millerite time period. Is there a prophecy about a false presentation taking place in 1840? There isn't. There isn't. Okay, so you may not be aware. Now, I said that at the outset. You may not be aware of all the places that this passage in Great Controversy is under attack. There are people that have written papers arguing that these two paragraphs were snuck into the Great Controversy by Uriah Smith. That's an argument in Adventism. Why? Why? Because this is the foundation of Adventism, brothers and sisters. This is the foundation of Adventism. If you can break this foundational block, you're going to challenge everything the Millerites had to say. Because this is the prediction that confirmed the year-day principle before the whole world. And this prediction, brothers and sisters, it's right here. It's on the 1843 chart. Now, the reason this brother in this congregation was making this case is because he's attempting to teach something new about the trumpets. Trumpets take place after the close of human probation is his assumption, okay? So in order to retain credibility as a Seventh-day Adventist, he's got to make a case why Sister White was wrong in the Great Controversy. So he does that, and then he begins to set forth his idea of the trumpets being a counterfeit seven last plagues during the identical time period. And but my point is this, brothers and sisters. The trumpets are a foundational understanding to the Millerite movement. And now if you go back to your last present in the book under the three woes, I'm on page 173. We want to show you another triple application of prophecy, and we want
73?
No, what page is it for you?
Very last page is,
very last page. We want to show you another triple application of prophecy, but brothers and sisters, you're only going to see this triple application of prophecy if you retain the pioneer understanding of the seven trumpets, and that understanding is illustrated on this 1843 chart, which Sister White says was directed by the hand of the Lord and should not be altered. If I can turn real quickly to a statement by this is Josiah Litch, the one that Sister White commented on in Great Controversy. This is in page 27 of this book. This is where the author of this book is going to summarize Josiah Litch and the pioneer understanding of the seven trumpets. Okay, and this is worth understanding because it's spot on. According to Litch, the sounding of the seven trumpets symbolized the instrumentalities, now he's quoting Litch, the instrumentalities by which the Roman Empire was to be overthrown and subverted and finally ruined. He indicated that under the first four trumpets, Revelation 8, the western part of the Roman Empire fell. Under the fifth and sixth trumpet, Revelation 9, the eastern empire was crushed. And finally, under the seventh trumpet, that's our time period, Great Babylon entire will sink and rise no more. The pioneer understanding is that the first four trumpets of Revelation 8, were the historical forces that brought to a conclusion Western Rome. Remember, in the year 330, Constantine moved the capital to Constantinople, and suddenly the Roman Empire is divided into East and West. And it's destined to turn into 10 kingdoms, but first it's divided into East and West. And Odoacer, Attila the Hun, Genseric, and Alaric were the four historical forces that fulfilled the first four trumpets that brought to a conclusion the Western Rome. And by the year 476, there was never again an Italian that was running the government of Rome. It was one of the barbarians from that point on. That was the first four trumpets. Foundations of the Seventh-day Adventist Message and Mission by Gerhard Damsteth. That the next two trumpets, and here's where we're going to focus on. There's seven trumpets. And in the book of Revelation, the last three trumpets, the fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpets, they're also identified as woes. There's seven trumpets, but the last three trumpets are three woes. The pioneers understood that the trumpets are the historical forces that bring down Rome. First four trumpets, Western Rome. Next two trumpets, Eastern Rome. Seventh trumpet, modern Rome. So definitely the woes are about Rome. A triple application of prophecy is about Rome. And I'm not making the distinction about the last three trumpets. The book of Revelation is. It's saying the last three trumpets are three woes. And when you approach the three woes under the rules of a triple application of prophecy, you find that in the first woe and the second woe, which are illustrated right up here on this chart, pioneer understanding, the characteristics of the first woe, when combined with the characteristics of the second woe, they identify the characteristics of the third woe. It's a triple application of prophecy. We've already showed you briefly four of them on the testimony of two or three things established. So what I'm suggesting is we've established this rule. Now we're going to bring this rule to the three woes. The summary, perhaps you haven't read the pioneer understanding of the fifth and sixth trumpet, the first and second woe recently. But what I'm going to summarize their understanding as, there's no way that I'm taking it out of context with them. It's not. This is all drawn from their conclusions. The first woe, the fifth trumpet, was Muhammad. It's the beginning of Islam, what they called Muhammadism in that time period. And it began in the fifth woe. It was in Arabia. And it's the beginnings of Islam. And Islam is a subject of Bible prophecy. If you go to Genesis 16. We have a study where we go through this in detail. We're not going through this in detail tonight, but I'm just going to tell it to you in a simple fashion. The number 12 is a symbol of God's kingdom. 12 disciples, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 foundations in the city. 12, you can show over and over again, is a number connected to God's kingdom. And who was Abraham's firstborn?
Ishmael
was his firstborn, but he wasn't the one that was to be the receiver of the covenant promises, correct? But how many sons did Ishmael have? 12. And as you trace the story of Ishmael down through Bible prophecy, you find that the descendants of Ishmael have a prophetic and historic relationship to God's people all throughout time. And the relationship is very easy to see. It's easy to demonstrate. They were used as a tool to bring chastisement and judgment on God's people, but they were also used to protect God's people. When Joseph was being sold into slavery in Egypt, who was it that saved his life? And the Ishmaelites come by, and you can go into small stories like that throughout the Bible, where the Ishmaelites, descendants of Ishmael, are used to be deliverers for God's people. Once Islam comes into history during the time period of Muhammad, there are two streams of translations that are used to produce Bibles. There's a corrupted stream called Vaticanus, and then there's the pure stream, the received text. And in history, the people that preserve the received text, preserve the pure word of God, was Islam. During their when in their height of glory, they had a great emphasis on education, and they took those ancient Hebrew scrolls and Greek scrolls and copied them over and over again perfectly without adding any of their foolish thoughts in like they did in the other streams of translations. The Lord used Islam to preserve the Word of God. And it used Islam during this fifth trumpet, first woe time period to spread out across northern Africa into southern Europe and up all the way around Europe and prevented the Catholic Church from spreading around the world. There's just many ways you can show that Islam has been both a deliverer and one that brought chastisement to God's people. If you read the writings of Martin Luther points to Islam being the ones that preserved the Protestant Reformation, because every time the papacy was going to come and attack the reformers, Islam would come down out of northern Europe and the armies of Rome would have to turn and go and defend against Islam. And that's what got the Protestant Reformation a foothold. So they've been used by God as a preserver, but also one that brings punishment. So when you come to the fifth trumpet, the time period of Muhammad, in Revelation chapter 9, the characteristics that the pioneers identify, and this isn't all of them, but the ones that we want to set out, the basic ones, is they were going to torment the armies of Rome, the armies of the papacy during that time period. And their mode of warfare is specifically symbolized and identified in Revelation 9, and the pioneers understood it. Their mode of warfare was that they would strike suddenly and unexpectedly. You know, the stories of the Arabian horses coming up over the sand dunes and chopping the people up before they even knew the horses were there and being gone in the wind before the blood was done flowing. That's the mode of warfare of Islam during that time period. And in the passage in Revelation 9, it says they were directed by their tails, and Isaiah 9:15 identifies their head as the prophet that teaches lies. Okay. You want to have a prayer or just take a break? Just take a break. You can switch the tape and then we'll continue on. I want to get through this and then have time for questions, and I'm running out of time.
Taking a break?